Well, you have just heard from the best, the master of transfer of technology. Pedro's work in this area goes back all the way to the very beginning of discussions in this matter, and he gave a quite comprehensive and very well-organized presentation. And so, and moreover, as if the sheer brilliance of it wasn't good enough, he started his presentation at 13 minutes to 9, and he finished his presentation at 13 minutes to 9. So we're left with plenty of additional time to continue. So my talk, which isn't on a PowerPoint, you might consider it a commentary on what Pedro has just said, kind of a series of thoughts, and hopefully well organized enough for you to follow. So developing and emerging market countries today really have unprecedented opportunities to leapfrog technology development, principally because of changes in not only the internet and communications technologies, but also in transport technologies and so forth. And we have a rapidly evolved capacity for moving technology between countries, moving production between countries. We see it at this very moment as we have a modest trade war going on and companies rapidly shifting production facilities from one country to another, and talking about the fact that it's a bit sticky, but it's still possible today to move technologies very quickly, and really I think in that way to advance technological development very quickly. And these opportunities exist despite, I think we all recognize, we're living in a very chaotic global economic environment at the moment. One of the trends that is very clear, both in terms of actuality and in terms of government rhetoric, is that we're in a period of localization of production. Whether we're in the United States, in China, we're in India, there's a real focus today on made in. In fact, that's India's motto as well. You know, make in India, made in the USA. China's government policies today are very much directed towards localization. If we look at it from the standpoint of development in emerging markets, the real scarce resource is investment capital. So what countries are really doing is competing to provide the best environment for investment of capital, because that's what's really necessary to move the technological spectrum forward. And just one note, another important condition or precondition to technological development is also, call it absence of corruption in government. It's not focused on very much, but one of the biggest taxes on development is corruption. It takes money away from business and investment. It takes money away from consumers. Perhaps blockchain technology will help us overcome some of the problems of production by actually bypassing governments in the process of transfer of products. A key question for developing and emerging market countries is how much of the national economy to protect through tariff, trade, and tax measures in the interests of local development, bearing in mind that consumers bear the cost of this protectionism, so you have to balance protection on one hand and open markets on the other. Of course, we're here mainly to discuss intellectual property and transfer of technology. As you well recognize, and I'm sure have heard many times over the course of the past 10 days or so, it's a two-edged sword in the area of development. On one hand, it provides the mechanism for private parties to securitize transfers of technology, engage in out-licensing and other components, training and so forth. And it's important because it allows local businesses to protect their own innovation and their own branding. On the other hand, it is the mechanism by which foreign investors protect the monopolies that they have over technology within the local market, They restrict access of technology to technology by local entrepreneurs, and therefore IP solidifies potential market dominance. So again, as with most things, it's a question of balancing the interests of the holders and the interests of those interested in diffusion. The rules of the game established at WIPO and WTO were largely designed by industrialized country government officials. The intention was to maximize the benefits for the foreign investors, to allow them to capture the value addeds of production. And the key to all of that is this idea which Pedro was talking about, non-discrimination. You have to treat domestic investors and IP holders the same as foreign investors and IP holders, and therefore you shouldn't give preferences to local entrepreneurs. This is a very troublesome rule when looked at from the standpoint of developing countries seeking to improve the local environment. We'll revert to that. Now, Pedro mentioned, and this is something I dealt with a lot in the past few years doing a study of the development and evolution of the Chinese pharmaceutical market and looking at country characteristics. But the great success story in technological development over the past three decades has been China. But as Pedro already mentioned, the problem of looking at China, which was the same in looking at it specifically in the pharmaceutical sector, is it's a model that is very difficult to replicate for other countries. Because what are these characteristics that China has, and how could they instruct others? Well, it has a very large population, which is both an attractive consumer market and a very large labor pool. It has a top-down government with virtually unchallenged control in terms of adopting and implementing legislation and regulations and control of the banking and the financial system. It started with a very weak IP system that didn't discourage local entrepreneurs from appropriating foreign technologies for their own benefits, allowing significant leapfrogging of technology at a very low cost. It has a large labor pool that has worked for until now with very low wages and subject to very tightly controlled work environments. The culture highly values education and science. And again, the strong central government was willing, and the provincial governments, to tolerate environmental degradation in the names of economic progress, a process which it's now trying to reverse, but this went on for some 20 or 30 years, and it's a very difficult situation. Of course, today the situation in China is fairly different. It's making its move to take the lead role in technology and economic power. It's encouraged the private sector to a certain extent, although still, if you're dealing with successful Chinese companies, you find that most of them are minority, if not majority, government-owned even today. IP protection has been significantly strengthened, as well as enforcement. Foreign direct investment, including technology transfer, has been encouraged. The government engages in detailed advanced planning in all of these areas and is looking for key roles in aerospace, telecommunications, electric vehicles, biotechnology, and the government subsidizes R&D in these areas. And it has sufficient economic and military power to really be able to resist pressures from outside. So China is doing a great job. Many people think China's the economy of the future. But at the same time, for most countries, you can't look to China and say, well, I'll do that, because it's simply not something that's possible for most other countries. And also from an economic standpoint, and studied in some detail by leading economists, China has had a policy of targeting specific industries, which is what has led to what is referred to as increased economies to scale, which has allowed it to take market dominance in certain narrow sectors, but essentially gives them a first mover advantage, which is very difficult to fight back against once they've achieved market dominance. So we'll come back to China a little bit later. looked at historically, there was a prevalent belief back in the 1970s by development economists that developing countries could engage in practices which would essentially reverse the terms of trade. And the leading thought in that area, late 1960s, early 1970s, was the Andean Pact in Latin America, which was a very highly evolved, very well thought out legal architecture for both Decision 24, requiring disinvestment down to minority ownership, and Decisions 84 and 85, which demanded various controls on transfer of technology. Going back a little bit to the China illustration, the problem was that while this was a very well thought out set of ideas, the Andean Pact countries didn't really have the power to make this work. So if they said to an IBM or a DuPont, you have to transfer majority ownership to us, IBM or DuPont would say, well, we'll simply leave. We don't need to stay here. And this effort fairly rapidly dissipated, and today is only a thin shadow of itself. The 1990s witnessed, late 1990s, a very strong effort by NGOs requesting that governments issue compulsory licenses on foreign technology, particularly in the pharmaceutical sector, as a means to lower prices and stimulate production. This didn't really lead to any scaled-up practice by governments to issue compulsory licensing. It did eventually lead to the creation of something you're probably familiar with, the medicines patent pool, which is a voluntary licensing scheme, which has had beneficial effects, and many Indian generic companies were able to produce patented medicines and distribute them throughout the developing world at very low cost. But it really wasn't a transfer of technology. The Indian companies already had the capacity to produce these medicines, and in many cases were already doing it. It really just was a transfer of authorization. And going back to a point Pedro made, as a practical matter today, when we look at the real politic landscape of transfer of technology, really encouragement of foreign direct investment and licensing of protected technologies has become the only viable means for most developing countries to secure inward transfer of technology. Even assuming for the sake of argument that a smaller developing country could issue compulsory licenses and develop technology in a particular area sufficient to satisfy the local economy, it wouldn't be able to export the finished products of that technology because of patent protection in other countries. So you'd really be stuck with a very narrow market for your products, making that type of activity problematic. Today, we're really living in a top-down global economy with the major technological actors and developers, China, the United States, some countries in the European Union, India coming on a bit, really dictating the terms of technology and investment, and everybody else really being takers in this area. So for most developing countries, speaking realistically, it's really a matter of developing the capacity for absorbing foreign technology and trying to strike the best bargain in terms of the deals or arrangements that can be made in that regard. For most countries at modest levels of development, food and nutrition, healthcare and basic education are priorities, as well as energy generation are major concerns. When we look at localization, so here's an area where India is trying to take a leadership role in localization of production. We have now a well-known case at WTO, the India Solar case. But India made a decision, if we have a vast need for low-cost energy supplies, we want to solarize the country, and naturally, the argument from China and the United States was, well, open markets dictate that India should buy from the lowest cost source of supply, so you should buy your solar panels from China, you should buy your solar panels from the United States. And India said, well, yes, that might make some sense from a short-term trade perspective, but we're going to develop a national preference program. We're going to make and buy in India. And then they were sued in the WTO by the United States for the local preferences that they put on with respect to solar energy. And this then gets into that question of discrimination. Looked at from a pure Adam Smith terms of trade standpoint, the traditional trader would say, well, yes, India should buy from the lowest cost source of production, shift into its areas of comparative advantage, and take advantage of specialization of the global economy. But that's terribly unrealistic from an India standpoint. I mean, India has a tremendous labor pool. It has tremendous needs in the area of energy generation. It has tremendous needs for industrialization and building up its technology and local production capacity. So if India is going to be spending billions and billions of dollars buying solar panels, why on earth would it want to buy them from China? And this just ties into the localization concept, right? But these ideas, this is just my own view, of course, but I support India in this process of localization. I mean, doing what makes sense for the national economy, for preserving the environment, and not necessarily listening to Adam Smith. But this runs into problems with WTO. So India has trouble with its program. Another very important area is pharmaceuticals, where developing countries tend to have very large trade deficits, particularly with respect to originator pharmaceuticals, and the most significant outlays are expensive patented foreign products. So, of course, one good answer to that is local production. And WHO and others have been doing a lot of pushes towards encouraging local production. But it's a difficult thing in the pharmaceutical area for a variety of reasons. One is just the way the pharmaceutical industrial base works. A country is going to have requirements for many different kinds of medicines. So you can't simply say, I'm going to build two or three factories and I'm going to make the country self-sufficient in the production of medicines, because it's very difficult to, you can't just shift a medicine supply line. So when you're planning for local production, you need to really do detailed advanced studies of what are the most important medicines for the local population, which are the ones we could manufacture. And you have to develop a thought-out government plan for how to localize production in the medicine sector and also how you're going to go about acquiring the technology. You also have the problems today where the production of biologics medicines is very complex and technologically, environmentally sensitive, so it's a bit difficult in many cases to develop biologics local production. But with that said, I'm a big believer in transfer of technology and moving into local production in medicines. The African Union is doing a lot of work in this area. And, of course, very few countries still are willing to take on the global originator pharmaceutical companies in terms of compulsory licensing and so forth. So most of the efforts vis-a-vis patents and other forms of exclusivity are really devoted to just making sure that patents roll off as soon as possible and the generic products can enter the market. And you still have very little activity in terms of compelling transfers of technology in this area. China and the United States are locked in a conflict for predominance in the development and implementation of new technology, particularly in the areas of aerospace, biotechnology, telecommunications, electrification of vehicles, alternative energy resources. And as you know, the defense sector in the United States has become increasingly concerned about the trend towards parity with the Chinese military, and particularly with Chinese cyber penetration of U.S. defense firms and transfer of technology. And also, as you know, up until now, China has really been the inward recipient of technology, but it's become a very long way to achieving technological parity with the United States and Europe, and in another decade or 15 years, I suspect we'll see parity. We see parity and even parity plus in some sectors. If we go all the way back to the early 90s, the U.S. companies, the U.S. multinationals and the European multinationals were very willing partners to invest in China, even recognizing that they were going to open their technology up to appropriation. They typically wouldn't transfer their leading edge technology, but their second or third generation technologies to China. Because they perceive the advantages of investing in a very large market and expressing a kind of ephemeral belief that at some point the U.S. government would step in and protect them somehow and begin to claw this back. Well, maybe this is happening now. The U.S. is trying to claw this back, but I think this is we use the metaphor closing the barn door after the cows have left the barn. I don't think the door can be closed on China anymore. China has become a self-sufficient technological developer. We may be able to slow it a bit, but we're not going to prevent China from achieving technological parity with Europe and the United States, even though the Trump administration has been willing to challenge China, and the United States has self-evidently been taking extra WTO inconsistent measures to fight back against China. It's raised tariffs on a non-MFN basis. It has, gone beyond bound tariffs against WTO rules, and threatening the architecture of the WTO system. There's a history of that. I mean, I don't want to overemphasize that as necessarily being such a bad thing. We've had other times in WTO or early GATT history where countries pushed against the existing framework to require or demand reform, and that's what the United States is doing now. Pedro mentioned the conflict about patent licensing. So one of the things the United States went after was alleged discriminatory patent licensing conditions imposed by China. And to be clear, the conditions being imposed by China, if they were imposed on a non-discriminatory basis, wouldn't be particularly problematic, right? Prohibitions on grant back licensing. Requiring that the licensee doesn't need to pay royalties after termination of the license. Requiring the patent licensor to indemnify the licensee in the event of a challenge. All of those are fairly normal licensing conditions, and there's no reason a government couldn't mandate those conditions under the TRIPS agreement. The TRIPS agreement only requires that you be able to conclude licenses, not the conditions on which the licenses are concluded. But the fact that China imposed those conditions, according to the United States, on foreign investors but not local Chinese companies, that was and may still be the TRIPS problem. And that would be an issue. But the reason the United States suspended its WTO legal action, my assumption is the Chinese said that they were preparing to change those rules. My assumption is they've changed those rules and that this case is essentially over. But looking at, one of the things to look at is the activities of Chinese competition authorities. So, China has been fairly aggressive in policing its market in terms of licensing conditions, and one of the targets of its efforts have been a company called Qualcomm. You're probably familiar with this, the modem chip provider, and China took major enforcement action against Qualcomm to the great consternation of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Chamber of Commerce in China. But in this regard, and I strongly encourage you to read it, although it's quite lengthy, is Judge Lucy Koh's recent decision in the case FTC, Federal Trade Commission, against Qualcomm in the United States, because Judge Koh was looking at the very same practices that the Chinese competition authorities were looking at, and these had to do with the licensing conditions of so-called standard essential patents. And Qualcomm was imposing very high royalty rates on purchasers of modem chips through the terms of patent licenses, and requiring companies to pay royalties on the basis of the entirety of the smartphone as opposed to the contribution of the modem to the smartphone. So in other words, you took the whole value of the smartphone, $600 or $700, and charged a 5% royalty on that, rather than on the value of the modem, which might have been a $20 part, and 5% on the royalties of that. So collecting very high royalties on a very small part, that in and of itself might be okay if you could get away with it. But the problem was that Qualcomm was the dominant market actor. So Qualcomm was the only company that was making these particular types of modems at a dominant position on the market. And if a company refused to pay those royalties, as Apple did, right, as Apple eventually did, Qualcomm threatened to, and in some cases, including with Chinese companies, to cut off supplies of the modem. So Qualcomm would say, fine, if you don't want to pay us, we won't supply you with the modem, but then you couldn't make your smartphone. So they were abusing their dominant position. And Judge Koh ruled that that was a violation of the Sherman Act and is requiring it to get rid of those conditions and only to charge the value on the particular modem part. It's both a very interesting case for those of you who are interested in licensing. I would say this is now the leading case on so-called FRAND licensing and anti-competitive access, anti-competitive licensing conditions. But the other part of it is this was the very same thing that the Chinese competition authorities were looking at and being criticized for, and the very same conditions that Apple was challenging eventually successfully. But the main complaint of the U.S. against China is forced technology transfer, as Pedro mentioned. And this is the idea that, and the Chinese, according to the U.S., haven't really codified this. It's more in the nature of collusive activity in the antitrust or competition context. But if you want to establish a joint venture, there's subtle pressure that if you want your joint venture approved, you have to engage in transfer of technology contracts or conditions, which the U.S. refers to as forced technology transfer. And since this isn't really prohibited by WTO rules today, the United States isn't going after China as a TRIPS agreement complaint, although Europe is, but Europe can't possibly win that case. The U.S. is going after China under provisions of Section 301, which allow it merely to take action if someone is behaving in an unreasonable or discriminatory manner, and that's the basis for imposing the penalties and the basis for the trade war. So the basic argument is China is doing something unfair to U.S. companies by forcing them to transfer technology as a condition of entering the market. And Pedro showed you the conditions being negotiated in the trade and investment agreements, which basically says, thou shalt not do that as a condition of foreign direct investment. I have a different view of that. It's not something you'll hear from the U.S. Trade Representative, maybe many others, but I don't see a problem with this concept of what is referred to as forced technology transfer. What countries on the inward end are offering is access to markets. China's offering access to a very large market. It doesn't
the theory of the multinational company is you provide us with low-cost labor, you manufacture, we capture the value added on export. And so you get a very small part of what is ultimately the large amount that we're going to get based on our foreign investment. The Chinese say, but that's not the deal we want. I mean, we want the technology, not just to provide you with low-cost labor. So if you want access to the market of 1.3 billion people, you have to agree as a condition to entering the market to do that. Well, you can see the Chinese have argued, I'm not saying they're not going to change the rule, they probably will, right? But, you know, the Chinese said, you know, it's up to the U.S. companies, it's up to the European companies. If they don't want to transfer technology, they don't have to transfer technology and they don't enter the market. But that's what we're offering, right? So that's the terms of the deal, and this goes back a little bit into these ideas of the 1970s. But countries entering into trade and investment agreements with the United States or Europe today are being required to accept these provisions that say you won't demand technology transfer as a condition of the foreign direct investment. So then you're stuck with otherwise trying to negotiate the best terms of the deal that you can under the conditions in which you're not allowed to really dictate the terms of trade, which leaves you as in negotiating the best deal possible under the circumstances. So that's kind of the current situation in respect to technology transfer in that regard. Of course, Huawei now is using its very large patent pool and beginning to threaten U.S. companies doing business in the United States with enforcement of Huawei patents. This is a very interesting development as well, something I've been talking about for a number of years. The United States has been demanding strong patent protection, strong patent protection, strong patent protection, without recognizing the day was going to come in the not-too-distant future when Huawei would be in the United States demanding that you pay for their patent portfolios of 1,000 Huawei patents that could cover most of the U.S. telecoms market. Now I wonder if you'll hear from the United States, well, we used to believe in strong patent protection, but maybe now we can see that there was another side of that equation. The one place where I think you have fair grounds for criticism vis-a-vis China, but China certainly isn't alone, is government cyber hacking of networks. That seems like an unfair trade practice, particularly when you're hacking into public utilities and the defense sector and so forth, and that's something that needs to be controlled, but that's not something that really can or will be controlled under the TRIPS agreement. That's more a question of diplomacy and bargaining power and so forth. And my suspicion is, like most other things in this area, that ultimately this is a matter for cyber defense, that this is the industry of the future, encrypting, completely controlling your networks. And the real problem that's left at the end of the day is humans, right? If you look at the big cyber attack cases, they mainly involve, at some point at the end, exploiting a vulnerable human who allows entry into the system and somehow bypassing the cyber control. But this is the very cutting edge, and I think where we are today. Well, we've really entered, for lack of a better term, a new and messier world of IP and technology relations. It's not well suited to governments by the TRIPS agreement, but rather diplomacy and balance of economic interests. The military side of it makes it only messier, not only messier, but also more dangerous. And it remains to be determined how our countries that are not part of the great power dynamic are going to accommodate to this new world. During the Cold War from 1946 to 1989, a bit more than four decades, countries of the so-called Third World tried to play off the major military powers against each other. Today, we may be looking at a situation in which countries that are in the lower levels of development are playing countries off technologically against each other, but I don't expect it to truly to be a bipolar world. And I've mentioned the U.S. and China. I don't mean to discount India which is also moving up the technology curve pretty rapidly, and we might be looking at least for another decade or two, more of a tripolar world as India becomes a more dominant force in this arena. We're living in a world of ascendant nationalism, various reasons why this is occurring, widening economic disparities leading to buildups of internal pressure, politicians seeking to divert claim to immigration and the fact of immigration itself. But this all can't all be blamed on Donald Trump. The Europeans presaged these problems even before Trump was elected in the United States. And we become, in times of economic uncertainty, individuals become fixated on simple targets that are used by politicians. So even though we may, in some sense, be living in the best of times, we haven't had a major world war in more than 50 years. I realize it's not perfect, but we've been in relative peace, relative economic prosperity, but it still, I suppose, seems like the worst of times. New agreements to address the technological landscape seem to be needed, particularly to address the global technological infrastructure and the weaponization of information. WIPO and the WTO are the existing fora and could conceptually be used to negotiate agreements in these areas, but for the moment prospects seem to be fairly limited. I'm tempted to say that we're going to be muddling through a rather chaotic environment for the next several years, and Geneva probably isn't going to be the focus of attention. Well, I haven't done the type of job my very well-organized friend Pedro has done. These are more or less the chaotic thoughts to go along with our chaotic international environment, but I hope at least a few of these thoughts have proved interesting. So, thank you.